From the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising, and I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. It's Monday, May 18th, 2015. Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. That's the title of a new book by Pulitzer Prize-winning author Chris Hedges. We'll hear a major address today by Hedges. And Palestinian-American graphic novelist Leila Abdel Razak joins us in studio to discuss her new book, Badawi, the story of a Palestinian refugee boy told through arresting visual art. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Rahul Mahajan. He's a sociologist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Hi, Rahul. President Obama this morning is announcing major federal-level changes to how police acquire military equipment. In a speech in Camden, New Jersey, Obama plans to restrict the availability of some military-grade weapons and simply ban others. The move stems from recommendations made by a task force he created in January as a result of unrest in cities like Ferguson, Missouri, over police violence. Meanwhile, a bloody shootout in Waco, Texas, on Sunday between rival biker gangs that left 9 people dead has sparked questions of police double standards. The shootout occurred at an annual gathering of mostly white gang members, some sporting white supremacist tattoos. Police were aware of the potential for violence and were on heightened alert. Nearly 200 people were arrested on various charges, but so far there is no evidence that any of the perpetrators were treated to the type of police brutality that unarmed African-American men routinely receive. Police confiscated more than 100 weapons from the scene. Well, Rahul, first, are you heartened by Obama's plan to reduce the militarization of police? And second, what do you make of this horrific example of white-on-white violence in Waco?
Well, I'd say, first of all, that I think it's good, and I think that the Obama administration has been at least somewhat responsive to this burgeoning political movement. And it's been remarked many times that Obama hasn't really been proactive on issues related to race, but I think his administration has always been much more open to going with the flow if there is, in fact, some sort of political push than past administrations would have been. So give him credit for that. Mm-hmm. I'd also say that, this is a horrible crime and a tragedy. Our sympathies should go to the friends and loved ones of the victims. And obviously, we're glad that people were not subjected to police brutality. We just see that others are also not subjected to it. But I have to say, there is a real culture of violence in parts of the white community. And, we have to see somebody standing up and talking about it. There's, whether it's meth addiction, addiction to guns, addiction.
Rahul, we're having some trouble hearing you, and we might bring you back on the phone with us. We're discussing the shootout in Waco, Texas, over the weekend when 9 people were killed, hundreds injured. There were 170 arrests, and images have surfaced of these shootings and their aftermath and police reaction to them on the internet. And certainly very few or no examples of or images of police violence. Rahul, let's turn to our next story. Barely had a 5-day humanitarian truce in Yemen ended when Saudi warplanes began bombarding the Persian Gulf's poorest nation late yesterday. The Saudi-led war coalition and Houthi rebels in Yemen had largely respected the brief moratorium to allow aid groups to deliver supplies to millions of Yemenis at risk of starvation. But the Houthis were hopeful of an extension to the truce to allow more time for aid delivery. Complicating matters, reports have emerged of an aid ship in the Gulf of Aden, chartered by the Red Crescent Society of Iran. The ship, which is violating a U.S. and Saudi-backed blockade, is carrying journalists, activists, and medical staff alongside supplies and is being protected by an Iranian Navy convoy. Iranian aid deliveries to Yemen have been regularly stymied by Saudi Arabia and the U.S., who worry about increasing Iranian influence in the region. Iran warns it will retaliate if the aid ship is attacked. Rahul, does Iran seem to be playing a dangerous game in Yemen? And is this really a proxy war between Saudi Arabia and Iran?
I mean, the United States started playing a dangerous game in Yemen, pretending that the the government had some kind of broad legitimacy and had, you know, the right to basically allow them to make these...
And you can switch your phone off because we're getting an echo. I think we can get you well on the video stream. Mm-hmm. Continue.
Drone strikes and other another attacks that were going to foment violence. The Saudis are playing a dangerous game, and yes, the Iranians are also playing a dangerous game. Now, whatever game is being played, a legitimate aid convoys, it's a violation of the laws of war to attack them. So Iran shouldn't need to threaten retaliation. They should not be attacked. There are, of course, all kinds of questions about monitoring and whether aid ships or aid provision is really aid. And I think those are questions for both sides. I would not be any more sanguine about U.S. or Saudi-provided aid in that regard than Iranian.
And finally, tens of thousands of Okinawans demonstrated for a third day in a row yesterday in response to the planned move of a U.S. military base on the Japanese-controlled island of Okinawa. There are tens of thousands of U.S. troops based there. That's about half the number present in all of Japan. Plans to move a Futenma Air Base have been stalled for nearly 20 years, but residents want the U.S. military base to be removed altogether. U.S. troops have a history of violence in Okinawa that included the gang rape of a 12-year-old girl by troops in the mid-1990s, an incident that initially prompted the relocation. There were protests across Japan over the weekend as well, and the protests highlight tensions between the Japanese government and Okinawa. Well, Rahul, the protests seem extremely well organized. Are they getting enough attention in the U.S., given that U.S. troops are at the heart of this matter?
You know, they've been getting very little attention in the U.S. I think that will change if they continue, and especially if they grow. I mean, it is a regular beat for some of the major newspapers. I have to say that, you know, the reason the United States has this hold over Okinawa is because of an extremely bloody battle fought in World War II, in which over 100,000 Okinawan civilians were killed. They were impressed, some of them were impressed into battle by the Japanese, others were killed by U.S. bombardments. I mean, the Okinawans have really suffered enough at the hands of both the U.S. and the Japanese to now have this sort of high-level collusion to thwart their very clear democratic will to have this airbase terminated rather than relocated is really tragic.
Rahul, thanks as always for joining us today. We'll talk to you next week.
See you then.
Rahul Mahajan is a sociologist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Despite our daily news cycle being dominated by the violence of war and poverty, reports abound of rebellions. In fact, historians point out that popular revolts often come in waves, and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges thinks that we're living during such a time when protest is once more peaking, pointing to 1848 and 1917, when worldwide political activism surged. Hedges singles out the Arab Spring movements against austerity in Greece and the Occupy movement in his new book called Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative of Revolt. Chris Hedges spent nearly two decades as a correspondent in Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and the Balkans, with 15 years at the New York Times. He's the author of numerous best-selling books, including Empire of Illusion, Death of the Liberal Class, War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning, and Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which he co-wrote with Joe Sacco. Chris Hedges writes a weekly column for the online magazine Truth Dig, and he spoke this past March at an event in Olympia, Washington. And today we'd like to share with you an excerpt of his speech.
Thank you very much. I learned to dress like a banker from Ralph Nader. Cy Hirsch does the same thing, so. It helps if you're white, so you come out with the imprimatur of the establishment to blow it up. I wrote a book before Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt, which some of you may have seen, which I did with the great cartoonist Joe Sacco. He's incredible. And if you haven't seen Sacco's book, Footnotes in Gaza, You should read it. It is an incredible tour de force. He and I had been in Gaza writing a magazine piece for Harper's. We had lived in a refugee camp called Khan Yunis for 10 days and just wrote day by day what that experience was like for the Palestinians, including, of course, in the afternoon, witnessing Israeli soldiers taunting in Arabic. I speak Arabic, and one afternoon we were near the edge of the sand dunes where the Jewish settlement was, and we hear in Arabic, ta'al, ta'al, which means come, come. And these kids are playing, 10, 11 years old, playing soccer with a rag ball in the sand. And my ears sort of went up because it was done over the loudspeaker of a Jeep. And the kids, you know, looked, and then we heard Arabic curse words, kasumak, which I won't tell you what it means, and kaub ibn kaub, on and on. And these little kids started throwing rocks. There was a cyclone fence that separated the Jeep from the rocks, the kids. The rocks could barely reach the Jeep, and it was an armored Jeep. And at a certain point, Israeli soldiers stepped out of that Jeep with M16s and shot these children. It was one of those moments as a journalist that is almost unbelievable. You can't quite comprehend what you're even seeing. And this happened on several, it usually happened after school on the same time. And the fact that these kids were being taunted, I mean, I've been in places like Sarajevo where children were shot by Serbian snipers, but I had never seen children taunted, enticed, and killed like mice in a trap for sport. And so we went to the hospital. So we had their names, the dates. We were there when the shooting took place. In several cases, I went to the funerals. And we wrote this up, and you can imagine the firestorm that created with the Israeli lobby in the United States. But it was kind of ironproof because we were there. We had all of the factual information that laid it out. And in the course of this story, we kept hearing about how in 1956, during the Israeli occupation of Gaza, in Khan Yunis as well as Rafah, Israeli soldiers, this was during the Suez Crisis. So in the Suez Crisis, Israel took it upon itself to occupy Gaza for 100 days. Ariel Sharon, Force 101, was in charge of it. How they had taken hundreds of young men of military age, corralled them actually in a school in Khan Yunis, and then executed them. And this was a story that it's just one of those moments in Middle Eastern history that had been completely lost, certainly to the outside world. And I put that in the story, in the original Harper's piece, which was edited out in the wisdom of the editors because it was history. And Joe was so incensed that he went back and spent 6 years tracking down these survivors who had witnessed this event and pieced it together in this utterly magnificent work, Footnotes in Gaza, which is really one of the great works of the Palestine-Israel conflict. And I remember when he sent me the copy, I went off into a secluded corner and read it alone, and I of course was weeping by the end. So he's an amazing artist, an amazing journalist, and the reason I wanted to do Days of Destruction, Days of Revolt with Joe, we wrote that book out of the poorest pockets of the United States, Camden, New Jersey, which per capita is the poorest city in the United States, Pine Ridge, South Dakota, where the average life expectancy of a male is 48. That's the lowest in the Western Hemisphere outside of Haiti. At any one time on Pine Ridge, 60% of the occupants have neither electricity or running water. We wrote it out of the coal fields of southern West Virginia. The produce fields in Florida, where you are constantly uncovering slave operations, that is undocumented workers from Honduras or Mexico or other countries held literally behind barbed wire and forced to work without pay. You'll hear periodically of officials uncovering oftentimes up to 100-200 workers being held like this. We ended with the Occupy movement. But one of the reasons I wanted to work with Joe in the book, aside from the fact that he's wonderful company, was because these people are invisible. And the level of poverty and despair that now afflicts, we're now closing in on 50% of this country, is virtually unseen on purpose. I mean, a corporate media that is, you know, in essence, blotted it out. But before I talk about the new book, I want to talk a little bit about a book that I wrote a few years ago. As kind of back, you know, one book kind of morphs into the next. And this was a book called Death of the Liberal Class, which started out for a big publishing house called Knopf. And Knopf had called me and asked me if I would be willing to write a critique of the American press. I mean, the irony, they called my agent. And the funny part about it is that the two previous people who they had asked to write the book, who had both declined, was the former editor of the New York Times and the former editor of the Washington Post. How I managed to be number three on the list is kind of mystifying, since the book they wrote and the book I wrote would bear nothing, no likeness at all. And it was also a very good lesson. Don't ever write a book, if you're a writer, that's somebody else's idea. So I wrote my Chomsky-esque critique of the American press and turned it in. You can imagine the editors at Knopf hated it and didn't quite know what to do, and then said that, okay, we'll publish it, but we're going to take out all the negativity. So that didn't go down particularly well. And I got Nation Books. You get half of your advance up front, and Nation Books doesn't have a lot of money. So I said, look, just give me the half. I mean, pay them back the half that they paid me, and you can have the whole book. And what happened in that transition was that I began to reflect on all of the pillars of the liberal establishment, because it's not just the press that's collapsed. It's labor, culture, which of course has been commercialized, the Democratic Party, the liberal church, which I come out of. My father was a minister. I'm a seminary graduate. And I wanted to ask why. Why did these liberal institutions that, as Karl Popper says, once made incremental and piecemeal reform possible? The kind of safety valve that exists within a capitalist democracy. What happened? And it led me back to the eve of World War I. A moment in history that's been pretty effectively erased from our consciousness. Because on the eve of World War I, you had powerful, radical groups that were rapidly transforming American society. You had socialist, large numbers of anarchists, I mean, even Yiddish anarchist newspapers, socialist groups, of course, the Wobblies, great socialist figures, Emma Goldman, publications like The Masses or Appeal to Reason, which had the fourth highest circulation in the United States, a socialist journal, which had kind of cornered the Robert Barron and the capitalist class. And at that moment, of course, there was really ever since the Civil War a strong strain of anti-militarism, if you can believe it, in America, and a deep reluctance on the part of the American public to become involved in World War I. But of course, what happened is that as the war continued, the arms manufacturers in the United States began supplying munitions and weapons to the British and the French. And the British and the French had to take out tremendous loans, courtesy of Wall Street, in order to buy those munitions. And towards the end of the war, with the collapse of Tsarist Russia, you had this moment when the Kaiser was able to transfer 51 divisions from the Eastern Front to the Western Front. And the fear on the part of Wall Street was that if the British and French were defeated, they would never be repaid. So suddenly Wall Street began to lobby the Wilson admin. And Wilson had run for re-election in 1916 on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." So Wilson's lobbied. To be fair to Wilson, you also had Germany's decision to sink Allied shipping. So American merchant ships were being sunk. And this created a kind of national outrage. And yet, when the decision came within the Wilson White House to declare war, they realized that these powerful socialist Debs, remember, was a fierce opponent of entering the war. And Debs had polled 6% socialist, 6% of the American vote, 900,000 votes. And there's this debate. I went into the archives at Princeton University. I live in Princeton. And actually pulled out the transcripts of these debates. And so you had Wilson with Walter Lippmann, who I think is a very dark figure in American politics, a guy named Arthur Brillard and others, and they're all debating with Wilson as to if they declare war, how are they going to effectively silence all of these radical groups that are against the war. And Wilson wants to immediately impose the Espionage Act the Sedition Act in order to essentially declare martial law, to shut these people down by force. And Walter Lippmann argues that this is a mistake, that by employing the understanding of crowd psychology pioneered by figures like Le Bon, Trotter, Sigmund Freud, and others, they could create the first system of modern mass propaganda that would, in effect, seduce most of the country into supporting the war effort. And then you use the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act to decapitate those radical elements like Randolph Bourne, Jane Addams, Debs himself, who refused to be sucked through that propaganda into the war effort. And if you look at Lippmann's book, which I think he published in 1922, Public Opinion, that's where Chomsky, when Chomsky and Herman write their book, Manufacturing Consent, that term, manufacturing consent, they take from Lippmann. And so we build the first system of modern mass propaganda, which uses the understanding that people are not moved by fact or reason, but by the skillful manipulation of emotion. And you get, it's the Committee for Public Information, it was known as the Creel Commission. It was headed by a figure named George Creel, former muckraking journalist, ends his career in the 1950s working for Nixon and McCarthy in the McCarthy hearings. And so you get a news division that every day is pumping out pro-war stories. Every publication is by law forced to publish editorials that support the war. The masses won't accept it, they shut down, Appeal to Reason does accept it, and throughout the war publishes pro-war stories. But what's fascinating is how effective that propaganda, Hollywood of course signs on immediately, the American Sniper has a long tradition of, Nazi-esque quality. In World War I they're publishing producing films which are the equivalent of American Sniper, called The Kaiser, The Butcher of Berlin, this kind of stuff. You have speakers going throughout the country, graphic artists. And when you read Randolph Bourne, who I admire immensely, or Jane Addams, who I admire immensely, part of their despair is not only how easily the masses are seduced into supporting the war effort, into this abstract ideal. So instead of running settlement houses and trying to better the lives of impoverished sweatshop workers on the Lower East Side, you are signing on for this Wilsonian crusade to make the world safe for democracy and the world to end all wars. And part of their despair is how easily the left itself has been seduced into the war effort. Jane Addams booed off of the stage in Carnegie Hall for denouncing the war. Randolph Bourne, of course, becoming a pariah. Debs, because he denounces the draft. I mean, they're just looking for a reason. In prison, goes to prison. And that became, I think, the seismic moment in American history. We had come out of the bloodiest labor wars in the industrialized world. Hundreds of American workers had been murdered. Thousands, tens of thousands had been blacklisted, wounded, driven from their jobs. This was unprecedented. We had a whole vigilante class of Pinkertons, gun thugs, Baldwin Felts. You especially can read about it in the Ludlow and Homestead and all the coal strikes. And at this point, the state or the capitalist class had found the mechanism by which they could destroy radical and populist movements. And so immediately after the war, and it's almost instantaneous, the dreaded Hun, which has been demonized throughout that period that America was at war, becomes the dreaded Red. And they tie it by claiming that Lenin got German money, which historically is actually accurate. He did get German money. But they tie it as if Lenin was a creation of the German war machine. And there's a writer that I like very much, who's not read much anymore, although he should be. His name is Dwight MacDonald. Dwight MacDonald, who was briefly a Trotskyite, but he was just unorthodox in everything he did. And there's a famous moment when Dwight MacDonald is writing for the Trotsky-isk journal in the 30s in New York, and Trotsky's reading it and having a fit, and finally writes a letter to all the Trotskyites in New York that says, every person has a right to their own stupidities, but Comrade MacDonald abuses the privilege, and he was thrown out. But Dwight MacDonald, he's also a beautiful writer, and he can write about culture, which is kind of rare, as presciently and thoughtfully as he can about politics. His beautiful essays on Joyce and literary essays. So he writes about this, the end of the war. And he said, I think, something very important, and that is that at the end of the war, mass propaganda and the state created for the first time what he calls the psychosis of permanent war. And he says all of the political theorists of the 19th century, including Marx, remember Marx actually hopes the Prussians win the war because it will further the workers' revolution. He said none of them confronted this disease of permanent war, where you are forever making war internally and externally.
Chris Hedges speaking in March of this year in Olympia, Washington, about his new book, Wages of Rebellion, The Moral Imperative to Revolt. This is Uprising. We'll be right back after this short break.
We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Friday, May 15th was the 67th anniversary of Al-Nakba, the day that Palestinians mark as the catastrophe of Israeli occupation, and which Israelis mark as simply Independence Day. Major rallies and demonstrations took place in the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and by Arabs inside Israel. Palestinians living in surrounding refugee camps also commemorated Al-Nakba on Friday. In fact, more than 5 million Palestinians remain refugees, at least 1.5 million of them living in camps in Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, and other areas. It is the story of just such a Palestinian refugee boy that forms the center of a graphic novel created by my guest, Leila Abdulrazak. The book is called Badawi, which is the name of a refugee camp in northern Lebanon. Leila Abdulrazak is a Chicago-based Palestinian artist and organizer, a recent graduate of DePaul University with degrees in theater arts and Arabic studies. As a student, she was active in the group Students for Justice in Palestine, where she helped to pass the DePaul divestment referendum. She's also a member of the National Students for Justice in Palestine Steering Committee, and she now joins me in studio. Welcome to Uprising.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you're incredibly young. You're only 22 years old. Tell us a little bit about your own background and how it has informed your work. I understand, do you have any formal art training?
So I went to the theater school at DePaul, so my art training, if you want to call it that, is more in theater. Mm-hmm. So I don't have, like, visual arts training, just, like, whatever classes I took in high school.
Hmm. Yeah. So you're just naturally talented to put pen on paper and beautiful black-on-white drawings that are telling the stories of a boy loosely based on one of your relatives.
Yeah, it's the story is actually about my father, so all the stories in the book are true stories. I didn't, like, fabricate any of them. And a lot of them, when I was starting, were just little anecdotes he told us growing up, like the kinds of stories that your parents tell you over and over again and you kind of get sick of hearing them. Like, and every family has those, so that's kind of the place I started from, and then it grew from there.
So your father was born in a Palestinian refugee camp in northern Lebanon, mm-hmm. this camp called Badawi.
Yes.
Which, you know, loosely, I believe in Arabic means Bedouin?
Yeah, it's derived from the word Bedouin, which is like a nomad or someone who lives, you know, not in one place.
So we hear a lot about the situation in Gaza. Mm-hmm. We hear a lot about the West Bank. We even hear about Palestinians living in Israel proper. We don't hear as much about mm-hmm. Palestinian refugees, but there are millions of them. How is the experience of Palestinian refugees different from Palestinians in the West Bank, Gaza, et cetera?
Well, it varies from country to country, right? So, like, each country where there are Palestinian refugees, a lot of them have different rules and regulations and ways of interacting with and dealing with refugees. And the situation in Lebanon is a really particular one because in Lebanon, Palestinian refugees cannot work most jobs, you know, obviously don't have citizenship, retain their refugee status, and also cannot own land. Like, there's so many restrictions against Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, so it's almost as if, well, it is, you know, you can't participate fully in Lebanese society as a Palestinian refugee. So, it's really... It's a different kind of oppression than what you face in the West Bank and Gaza. It's kind of a dual situation because you're still suffering from you know, the Nakba and the effects of that and not being able to return to your homeland and from Israel's actions. But you're also subject to, whatever the Lebanese government or whatever the government of the host country decides to, like, inflict upon you.
Hmm. And so there are now generations of Palestinian refugees who have remained in these refugee camps for so many decades. That means that there have been children who were born, grew up as refugees, and who may have never been on Palestinian land.
Mm-hmm.
How has the concept of Palestine kind of been idealized for them through stories?
I mean, even for, like, me mm-hmm. growing up outside of, you know, I haven't obviously grown up in the camps. I've grown up in the United States and in South Korea. But, like, even for me, for anyone in diaspora, I feel like a lot of us have all these stories in our head, have stories from our grandparents, things that our families have told us. The right of return is something that's not only a right that we feel like, oh, this is something we deserve because of the law, but it's something more deeply ingrained in us from an early age. And so, like, at least speaking from my personal experience anyways, and so, like, all of these things kind of create this longing to return and this longing for justice, even on an individual level. And that's not limited to people in the camps. That's Palestinians all over the world. Right. Yeah.
Now, your book has a cover that is this image of a young boy with his back to the reader and his hands clasped behind his back is very similar to or sort of has echoes of the image that we associate today with the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement of the spiky-haired, barefoot little boy who stands with his back to you. And there's a story there. Can you tell us that story?
Yeah, so that image is a direct reference to the work of Naji Al Ali. He is a Palestinian, well, he was a Palestinian political cartoonist. And he drew, he was drawing his political cartoons at the time, during the time of, and place that I was writing the book about. So he was based in Lebanon, and he was drawing cartoons about the civil war and about the Palestinian issue. And his character, Handala, is this spiky-haired boy with his hands behind his back and his back to the reader. And this character was kind of the symbol of the Palestinian refugee child. And he appeared in all of his political cartoons with all these... He would be standing there, and all these political events would be unfolding around him.
And this little boy is just observing them.
Yeah, for the most part. For the most part, yeah.
So this, the boy in your book, the boy at the center of your book, Ahmed, based on your father, you said the stories are all real. But in the end, is he sort of a composite of the stories of you know, could he be any Palestinian refugee boy living in a camp in Lebanon?
In a sense, yeah. I think, you know, a lot of what I've heard from people is that the stories are very relatable, regardless of whether or not you grew up in the camps, or also relatable to people who had experiences like that and see some of their own stories or see some of themselves in these stories. And, you know, the stories go beyond. A lot of times when people talk about refugees, especially Palestinian refugees, the discourse gets reduced to the circumstances that those people are living in. And those circumstances, yeah, they define some parts of, you know, they can, they're the context, right? But you're still experiencing all kinds of different things that any kid would experience. It's just you're dealing with these additional burdens. Right. So, like, the first story I wrote was about my dad playing marbles in the camp and how he kind of, like, set up a way to collect more marbles from the other kids. So, like, these are stories that, like, yeah, they're framed by whatever cultural or political circumstances he was surrounded by, but there's still stories about childhood and there's still stories about his own experience.
So the stories of children interacting with one another are obviously stories that you might see anywhere in any circumstance. They're innocent, they're ordinary sort of youthfulness, but then there's this ominous backdrop of violence, of war, of dispossession. How did you draw these pictures that are based on oral history,
right?
Which is quite remarkable. Did you travel at all to the camp in Lebanon, or did you base these drawings entirely on the stories your father told you?
When I began, it was really just based on what my father was telling me. I hadn't had a lot of opportunities to go to Lebanon before. I had been a couple of times, but I hadn't spent a very long time there. The first time I went, I was 15. But when I got older, I took about 6 months to study in Lebanon. And during that time, I spent a lot of time with my family. My family still lives in the camp. And so that, like, helped me actually put more detail into the drawings and stuff like that.
Now, in your work, there are motifs that are sprinkled throughout these the panels that you draw decorated with these distinctive geometric and floral patterns. What are they? And are they, is your... you know, your effort at putting them on paper also part of your your effort to keep Palestinian culture alive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. So those patterns are from tatriz. It's a kind of it's traditional Palestinian embroidery, basically. It's actually
your scarf. You're wearing a scarf. Yeah. For our TV audience.
Yep. So that's what that is. But yeah, there are patterns based on that. A lot of the patterns are. There's different patterns that are specific to different areas, different geographic areas. Those patterns are passed down through families. They're taught to, you know, people will teach each other, like, how to embroider this stuff. And so it's something that's passed down from generation to generation and varies based on what region you're in. And so incorporating those motifs, yeah, it was very intentional. And it was a way, because a lot of what Israel's doing with its ethnic cleansing, it's not only physical dispossession of people from their lands or massacres or anything like that, it's also there's a cultural component to it. And cultural... excuse me, cultural appropriation is one way that that they can kind of try to erase Palestinians. And so claiming, oh, this is Israeli embroidery. Oh, this is Israeli food. So I was very, very intentional when I was working on the book to incorporate aspects of Palestinian culture in that way, incorporate the tatriz, incorporate, you know, references to food in order to very deliberately take ownership of those aspects of our culture and remind people that, you know, we're not gone, we are still here, and these are Palestinian traditions.
Your work has been compared to Joe Sacco's Footnotes in Gaza, but honestly, I felt that it was closer to Persepolis by Marjan Satrapi,
right.
Iranian graphic artist as well. What are your influences?
You know, I think my my biggest influence is more Naji El Ali. I looked to his work a lot when I was writing the book as kind of a window into how people were responding to events during that time period.
And this is the same artist we referred to earlier who created the character that is now become the BDF's motto or slogan.
Right, yeah. So he was a huge influence. I think there aren't many graphic novels that are very well known about Palestine, and so like, and about the Middle East in general, and so I think that's why people will jump to relate it to Sacco's work or to Satrapi's work, even though like, you know, I think those are both distinct voices, and I understand why people make the connection, but you know, we're using very different approaches to storytelling in a way. So
the storytelling that you have done, going back to some of the stories that actually have come through, the idea that there are a stateless people living in these refugee camps, talking about the right of return to a land that you know, has remained locked out, that they have remained locked out of for so many years. How are these stories being passed down generation by generation? Are they being documented in print as you have done, or are they largely being passed down orally? Is there a danger of some of this history being lost?
Yeah, I think so. And that's why it was important to me to tell this story, because it's not that my dad's story is so unique. In fact, I think a lot of, if not all, Palestinian families have incredible stories, you know, that are passed down within the family, and that within Palestinian communities we'll share these stories, and a lot of us have similar stories, but outside of that community, those stories are not as frequently told. And so it is important to write them down because, you know, as Palestinians, we don't often get a chance to write our own history. Other people write it for us, and other people kind of erase the Palestinian narrative from that a lot of the time. And so I think it's important for us to not only keep telling those stories, because it's something that all of us can do, because all of us have those stories, but also to share them with other people, because if we don't, then the Zionist narrative will continue to dominate, you know, the discourse as it has for a long time.
One of the stories that did break into the news media of the sort of conundrum facing Palestinian refugees is the recent story of a Palestinian father named Wael Al-Sali and his son, who was stranded at Dubai International Airport for 2 weeks. They were from a refugee camp in Syria and were fleeing that war. and nobody would take them. He was finally, him and his son were finally granted entry into Jordan. And it's such a sad story because while Palestinians have lost their lands, the countries that they have been temporarily resettled into are also facing wars, mm-hmm. such as what's happening in Syria, which has sort of created a double trauma for many Palestinian refugees as well. We don't hear much about what is the fate of Palestinian refugees in Syria, where there's this horrific war, mm-hmm. or in Lebanon when mm-hmm. Israel attacks Lebanon.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering if you can also talk about what happened on Friday, May 15th, with the Al-Nakba commemoration, and give our listeners a little bit of background, because this is also something that forms a part of your story.
Right. So the Nakba, I guess you were explaining it at the beginning a little bit, but it's just Nakba Day is when we commemorate the massacres, the mass ethnic cleansing that occurred in Palestine. And my family was a part of that, was affected by that, and that's why my family went to Lebanon in the first place. So on October 30th, 1948, the Israeli army came into my family's village. They massacred, they lined up all the men. My grandfather happened to be traveling at the time. They lined up all the men in the village. They shot them and buried them in a pit. My grandmother was hiding in a building, and when my grandfather returned from his he was traveling for work. When he got back to the village, almost everyone had left because they were afraid that the Israeli army was going to come back and commit another massacre, because this was not an isolated incident. It was happening all over Palestine. And so my grandmother and my grandfather left when he returned, and they thought they didn't think they would be gone for long. They thought they would be able to come back. They left a lot of valuables there. They left everything behind. And to this day, Palestinian refugees have not been allowed to return. And my family members in Lebanon have not been able to return. My grandmother has not been able to return. My grandfather passed away a few years ago and was buried in a cemetery in our family's refugee camp. And I remember walking through the cemetery and just thinking, wow, this cemetery is full of many people who were never able to return, almost 67 years later. That's what we commemorate the Nakba for, to remember the ethnic cleansing, and to commemorate that, and to also acknowledge that the Nakba didn't end in 1948, that it's an ongoing process, mm-hmm. that Palestinians are continually being displaced and are continually barred from re-entering mm-hmm. the country.
The Vatican recently recognized mm-hmm. the state of Palestine, and I'm wondering how much hope remains among Palestinian refugees at this moment in history, when I don't know if this is being too hopeful, but it appears as though there is a beginning of a turning point.
Yeah, you know, I can't speak for Palestinian refugees, obviously, mm-hmm. since I'm not in that situation. But, you know, I think for me, personally anyways, I feel like if we lose hope, we've lost before we can even begin. So you have to keep hope, because otherwise it's really self-defeating. But at the same time, I think that acknowledgement of the state of Palestine, you know, it's significant in that it's a symbolic move. It's mm-hmm. significant in that it's it represents how times are changing. It represents how people are starting to, there's a shift in thinking, there's a shift in discourse, and that's what's interesting about it. But ultimately, it really doesn't mean much. There's still an occupation. Palestinians still haven't been allowed to return. And so, you know, people can make all kinds of statements, but at the end of the day, what it comes down to is that the occupation has to end. Palestinian refugees need to be allowed the right of return.
And so part of a possible turning point is a wave of activism on U.S. campuses that you, as a student, were deeply involved in, and I'm assuming you still are. And this is the movement to encourage campuses to divest from the State of Israel, and the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement as a whole has seen some limited but some serious successes just in the past couple of years alone. Can you tell us a little bit about the activism that you engaged in at DePaul University as part of the BDS movement?
Sure. So we had a divestment campaign at DePaul. A lot of schools do a divestment resolution where they take it to the student government. At DePaul, we did things a little bit differently. We did it as a referendum. So that means that we actually put the vote to the student body and asked the student body in the student government elections. There was a question at the end of the ballot that we wrote asking people, you know, if they thought DePaul University should divest from Israeli companies that are complicit in the Israeli occupation. And we won the vote. A majority of students voted in favor of divestment. But that didn't hold the university to anything. But it was still a significant victory because we mobilized a huge number of people to actually vote in the student government elections. If I'm not mistaken, I believe it was one of the highest, if not the highest, voter turnout at DePaul University ever. We're like a commuter school, so a lot of students aren't really involved in
campus
voting.
Politics,
right,
yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So it was a huge victory for us. People all over campus were, talking about it. And, it's interesting because when in history do you see an entire university campus debating what's happening in Palestine? That doesn't, that's what's unprecedented about this movement, is that it galvanizes a whole campus and gets students all over the campus really debating this this issue, which, is not very good for Israel. They kind of want to stifle that kind of critical conversation. So.
Yeah, and the fact that it has taken a hold on so many campuses, it was noticed by the New York Times, which had a very interesting article on May 9th that came under a lot of criticism. The article was entitled "Campus Debates in Israel Drive a Wedge Between Jews and Minorities." And what was really interesting about this article was that it tried to make the case that the BDS movement on U.S. campuses is pitting students of color against Jewish students. And people were quite upset because they are seeing common cause being made between Palestinian students and Black students, Palestinian students and Mexican students or Latin American students as a whole. How important is that? And even Native American students who do have, some parallels in history.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's very important. That kind of solidarity is extremely powerful and it's extremely dangerous. But I think the other interesting thing about that article is that the headline itself kind of paints Jewish students as a monolith. And there are plenty of Jewish students who have been involved in these divestment campaigns. In fact, I believe they actually interviewed a Jewish student who is involved in SJP for that article and did not quote that person.
Oh, wow.
And so...
because it would have sort of ruined the
right,
narrative.
Right, exactly. And so it's very misleading, and it's honestly insulting to anti-Zionist Jewish students who have been involved in this movement and who have put a lot into this movement.
Are you hopeful about the BDS movement taking a hold in the United States? Because, of course, the U.S. is a crucial player here. Mm-hmm. And recent months, we've seen some interesting politics here in the United States between the United States and Israel, all of which may change if there's, for example, a new Republican president, or even for that matter, if Hillary Clinton becomes president. But is there some hope, at least in terms of the U.S. narrative and action on this issue?
I mean, yeah, I think at the same time, though, we have to acknowledge that, I don't know how to explain this, the BDS movement is important and it's a central part of the overall push for Israel to end the occupation, afford the right of return, all of these things, but it's just one component of that larger struggle. But in terms of BDS, taking hold in the United States, I am hopeful because of the way it's kind of exploded on campuses. And even if it's not, even if big corporations, there are some big corporations that have, and some international, musicians and different people who have, you know, answered the BDS call, chosen to divest, pull money out, not perform in Israel, all these different kinds of things. But even if other big corporations aren't participating right now, or universities aren't actually pulling their money out right now, I think the explosion of and success of BDS on college campuses, the effects of that are something we're going to see down the road. And so I think even if right now it seems like it's hard, I think that it definitely indicates a shift in discourse and a shift in thinking.
Leila, I want to turn back to your book, Badawi. We started the conversation talking about how young you are and that you have no formal arts training in, you know, the kind of art that one would require to put such a book together. But there's also an interesting story about how your book came about. And it's sort of a hallmark of our modern times that we're living right in today. How did your book come about? How did you get a book deal as some, you know, as a first-time artist and first-time writer of such a book?
So I originally, like I said, was just illustrating small anecdotes. And when I started, I was just publishing those short anecdotes as a webcomic in little installments. They were kind of isolated stories, and posting them on my personal blog and then to my Facebook page to share them with my friends. Mm-hmm. And eventually, those comics, people started sharing them a little bit, and someone from my publisher, Just World Books, saw them and reached out to me and said, hey, do you want to make this into a graphic novel?
Wow.
And so that's how I started doing more research into the background and kind of trying to string all the stories together into a cohesive narrative.
Well, I want to wish you the best of luck, and thanks so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My guest, Leila Abdulrazak's new book is entitled Badawi, and it is just out now, available in bookstores. This is Uprising. Bipasha Shom is our senior producer. Anna Buss is our assistant producer. Christian Beck is our production coordinator. And Federico Garcia is our audio engineer. Alexander Hobbs is our technical director. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.